Perhaps no two words in the English language evoke more opposite impressions than do the two words spirituality and atheism. I suspect that most believers in God would find the very notion of a spiritual atheist to be patently absurd, and many atheists would probably agree with them. Granted, at first glance, the phrase spiritual atheist strikes one as a classic oxymoron, right up there with military intelligence, creation science, Middle East peace process, and jumbo shrimp. So why speak of the spiritual atheist? I'm reminded of a conversation I had years ago with a coworker. Somehow the subject of motorcycles came up, and I asked this guy if he owned a motorcycle. He said yes, and so I asked him what kind, what brand. At this point, he gives me a funny look. What kind? Mike, there's only one motorcycle. Then, like a total idiot, I said, you mean like a Honda? Now he gives me this look like I've just insulted his mother. He then informed me that there's really only one true motorcycle, the Harley Davidson. If you aren't riding a Harley, you aren't riding a motorcycle. You know, in a similar way, a lot of people seem to think that if you don't believe in God, you don't believe in anything. The atheist is often viewed in our society as a sort of philosophical zombie. Even setting aside all talk of salvation or damnation of the soul, most people seem to think that the atheist, by not believing in God, is somehow denying himself a spiritual dimension of life that only those who do believe in God can enjoy. I disagree with this. Having myself spent quality time on both sides of this theological fence, I can assure you that the atheist is not necessarily missing out on anything. In fact, I can honestly say today that my own spiritual growth began in earnest only after I had become an atheist. Now, if this strikes you as a somewhat ludicrous claim, and it probably does, then I hope during the course of our time together to persuade you to think otherwise. Let's begin our discussion by making it clear just what it is we mean by spirituality. To be sure, spirituality is a word that means different things to different people. Be that as it may, I think it's fairly safe to say that for most people, spirituality is that intangible dimension of the human experience arising from one's relationship with God. The stronger that relationship, the more spiritual the life. Based on this popular definition of spirituality, we can see that there are three ingredients that go into the making of a spiritual life. There's God, there's the person, and there's the relationship between God and the person. Now, at first glance, our definition would appear to mark the end of the road for the atheist. I mean, after all, an atheist is, by definition, someone who is without a belief in God. So game over, right? Well, maybe not. One thing that has become increasingly obvious to me over the years is that this word God means very different things to different people. When we say that spirituality arises from one's relationship with God, we need to be clear what we mean by the word God. If we can't define what God is, then in a very real sense, we simply don't know what we're talking about. To make sure we know what we're talking about, let's take a couple of minutes and briefly examine each of these three ingredients. And I want to begin by considering these three ingredients from what I'll call a traditional point of view. This traditional point of view corresponds more or less with what I was taught as a child, and it's a view that likely resonates with the beliefs of many Americans, if not most Americans. Let's start with the biggie, God. What is God? What exactly is this thing that the spiritual person is supposed to be having this relationship with? As someone who was raised in what might be called a Judeo-Christian family and culture, I was taught to think of God not so much as a what, but as a who. Like many people, I was taught to think of God as a sort of person. Granted, this God person possesses infinite power and knowledge. He's the creator of the universe. He's God. But he's still a kind of person. And because God is like a person, he is someone you can develop a personal relationship with. For example, God can be your friend. God wants to be your friend. He's someone you can talk to. He's someone you can go to in times of need. Ask, and ye shall receive. For many believers, God is like a concerned parent. They even refer to Him as their Heavenly Father. This kind of God is what many people call a personal God. Now, does a personal God have a body like we do? Well, some people think so. But that's not really important for our discussion here. What is important is that a personal God has a mind. A personal God thinks. Let's turn now to the second ingredient of our spiritual recipe, the person. And more specifically, that thinking part of the person, sometimes referred to as the human soul or spirit. Back in my religious days, I viewed the human spirit as a kind of ghost. I believed it to be an entity in and of itself, separate from my body, with the capacity to exist on its own, independent of my body. In fact, I believed my spirit would go on living and thinking even after my death, even after I had given up the ghost, as the Bible says. My spirit was the real me. My spirit was the thinker, the decision maker, the seat of the will. My physical body was little more than a sort of clunky container, not unlike a cookie jar, where all the good stuff is on the inside. In a sense, I viewed the relationship between my spirit and my body in much the same way that I viewed the relationship between God and the universe. I was the spirit behind my body. God was the spirit behind the universe. What we have then is a person and his God. Two intentional thinking beings, two minds. Hence, the potential for a meeting of these two minds, a relationship. And relationship is the third ingredient in our spiritual recipe. And it's this relationship between a person and his God that is the wellspring of the spiritual experience. And spiritual experience is what the spiritual life is all about. In the religious world, spiritual experiences come in all shapes and sizes. They run the gamut from a quiet sense of divine presence to a feeling of oneness with the universe, to praising Jesus, to speaking in tongues, to alleged healings, to visions, to flopping on the ground like fish out of water. There's even a church in Toronto where the worshippers squeal and howl like a bunch of farm animals. It's something they call holy laughter, although if you ask me, they sound like farm animals. The value believers place in these experiences is evidenced by the lengths to which they will go in order to induce these experiences. They pray, they meditate, they sing, they stop eating, they abstain from sex, they lock themselves in monasteries, they flog themselves with whips, they take hallucinogenic drugs. In a few extreme cases, some even kill themselves. They make these adjustments to their physiology in order to get in tune with the divine, or in touch with God. And when they finally do get in touch with God, or perhaps when God gets in touch with them, the resulting experiences manifest outwardly in the various ways I just mentioned. And all of these experiences, the believers claim, are the result of their relationship with God. Hence, all of these experiences qualify as spiritual experiences. But how about the atheist? Are there experiences available to the atheist that might, in some way, be construed as spiritual? Perhaps. Let's not forget that this word God means different things to different people. There are perhaps as many versions of God in the world as there are species of insect. I mean, let's face it, people worship everything from planets to penises and everything else in between. Not everybody views God in the traditional sense. Not everybody rides a Harley. Let me introduce you to a very non-traditional version of God. This version of God is referred to by Stephen Hawking in his book, A Brief History of Time. In the final paragraph of the book, Hawking writes, and I quote, "If we do discover a complete theory, it should in time be understandable in broad principle by everyone, not just a few scientists. Then we shall all, philosophers, scientists, and just ordinary people, be able to take part in the discussion of the question of why it is that we and the universe exist. If we find the answer to that, it would be the ultimate triumph of human reason. For then we would know the mind of God." End of quote. Now, what kind of God is Hawking referring to here? A personal God? A God who once destroyed the world with a flood and who sends people to hell? I seriously doubt that. For Hawking, God is the universe. God is reality. Hawking's dream of a complete theory, or theory of everything as some like to call it, is the hope that one day we will have reduced our understanding of the universe to a handful of basic principles. To understand these principles would be to understand why the universe behaves as the universe does. It would be to understand why God behaves as God does. It would be to know the mind of God. Now, granted, this is a very non-traditional definition of God, but it's a definition that some people are quite comfortable with, and it's a definition that will never clash with scientific inquiry. How about the human soul or spirit? What about the person? The traditional view seems to be that man's spirit is a ghost-like thinking entity with the capacity to exist independent of the body. As was the case with the concept of God, this traditional version of the spirit, although popular with the masses, is not the only way to view the thing. For some people, the human spirit is just the mind. Francis Crick wrote a book a few years back titled The Astonishing Hypothesis, The Scientific Search for the Soul. Now, when Crick speaks of the soul, he's referring to the mind. He's referring to a process that takes place in a physical brain. For Crick, the mind, or spirit, or soul, or whatever you want to call it, is not a separate entity. It's just a feature of the brain that will die with the brain. Perhaps you can see where I'm heading with all of this. These non-traditional definitions of God and spirit are perfectly compatible with atheism. If God is the universe, if God is just the whole of reality, well, I believe in that God too. Now, I don't call it God. I call it the universe, or reality. In a similar vein, I don't call the mind a spirit. I call it the mind. I avoid using the words God and spirit because I don't want to give people the false impression that I believe in a whole bunch of stuff that I don't believe in. You see, if I go around using words like God and spirit to describe how I understand reality, a casual observer is likely to get the impression, the false impression, that I hold beliefs similar to those held by other people who use the words God and spirit. People like Billy Graham, or the Pope, or Louis Farrakhan, or Osama bin Laden. People I don't agree with at all. Philosophically speaking, I want to make a clear and unambiguous distinction between myself and these other people. But I risk blurring that distinction when I use words like God and spirit, even though technically speaking, I might be able to get away with it. Now, I could take this one step further and avoid using the word spirituality. And most of the time I do avoid the word, and for the same reason. However, in an effort to demonstrate that not all atheists are zombies, today, I'm going to use the word spirituality. And here's why. I believe that spirituality arises from the relationship that exists between a human being, whatever his true nature may be, and reality, whatever its true nature may be. If we can agree that spirituality is a function of this relationship, then clearly, even the atheist can enjoy a spiritual life. And like his religious counterparts, the atheist too can enjoy spiritual experiences as a result of this relationship. And while these experiences might not be of the flop on the ground or speaking in tongues variety, they are experiences that, to this atheist at least, are nothing short of profound. There are five spiritual experiences that I want to discuss with you today. They are spiritual growth, spiritual awakening, actualization, legacy, and spiritual liberation. Let's talk first about spiritual growth. What is spiritual growth? Let's back up for just a minute. What is spirituality? Spirituality, as I am defining it here, as an atheist, is that intangible dimension of the human experience arising from one's relationship with reality. The spiritual life is rooted in this relationship. Accordingly, if we want to understand the nature of spiritual growth, we need to understand the nature of relationships. So what is the nature of a relationship? What is it about a relationship that makes it a relationship? What's the active ingredient? The active ingredient in all human relationships, I believe, is an understanding. And by understanding, I mean a mental representation of what something is. Think of a picture you have of one of your parents, your mother, let's say. Maybe you have a picture of mom hanging on your wall. Now, if I were to look at that picture, what would I see? Obviously, I would see a woman. By looking at this photograph, I might be able to guess at her age, maybe her race or the color of her hair, stuff like that. When I look at this picture, that's about all I see. But when you look at the picture, it's very different. Sure, you see the woman, her age, the color of the hair. You see all the same stuff that I see. But you also see a whole lot more than that, don't you? You see a lifetime of shared experiences with this woman. You know the sound of her voice. You know how she walks. You know what makes her laugh. And if it's your mom, you probably know what pisses her off. The point being, you can see a whole lot of things in this picture that I can't see. And the reason you can see these things is because you have an understanding of the woman in this picture that I don't have. Your understanding is much deeper than my understanding. Understanding is the real substance of any human relationship. And this is true of all of our relationships, not just our relationships with other human beings. It's true of our relationships with non-living objects, and even ideas and concepts. For example, imagine that I write down on a piece of paper a complex mathematical formula, a real nasty-looking thing with lots of Greek letters and weird symbols. Now, when most of us look at this formula, all we see is a meaningless jumble of Greek letters and weird symbols. But when a professor of mathematics looks at this very same formula, he sees all sorts of stuff that the rest of us don't see. His understanding of this formula is deeper. Hence, his relationship with this formula is deeper. In a very real sense, his relationship with this formula is more meaningful than ours. So again, understanding is the active ingredient in all human relationships. With this in mind, let's return to the question, what is spiritual growth? Well, think of it like this. If spirituality is a function of a relationship, as I've argued here, and if this relationship is a function of understanding, as I've argued here, then spiritual growth is the experience of growing your understanding. Now, if this sounds simple, that's because it is simple. But don't let the simplicity of the thing distract you from grasping the profound nature of this experience. I mean, think about this for a minute. When you come to understand something that you did not understand before, in a very real sense, you are now able to see something that you weren't able to see before. Now, this isn't a visual kind of seeing. It's not about sight. It's about insight. It's about pushing your mental grasp of a thing to a deeper level. For example, a symphony orchestra conductor hears things in a Beethoven symphony that the musical novice cannot hear. A skilled mechanic sees things in an automobile engine that the untrained eye is blind to. You can see things in a photograph of your mother. Years of shared experiences, good times, bad times. You see mom. The rest of us see only a woman. The experience of understanding is so simple and so obvious and so familiar that most people don't even think of it as a legitimate spiritual experience. But my friends, it is the quintessential spiritual experience. Understanding is what breathes meaning into our lives. Imagine trying to read a book written in a foreign language that you've never seen before. You have no idea what you're looking at. Just a bunch of strange-looking squiggles on pieces of paper. But let's say that you decide to learn this language, and after several months of intense study, you can speak it fluently. Now when you try to read the book, it's a very different experience, isn't it? these once meaningless squiggles have, almost magically, been transformed into meaningful words. What was once just a pile of ink-splattered sheets of paper is now a love story. Notice that we're still talking about the very same book. That hasn't changed. What has changed is your understanding of the book, and meaning has emerged from your new understanding. It almost seems like magic, yet it's just as natural as can be. Spirituality, as I define it, is that intangible dimension of the human experience arising from one's relationship with reality, from one's understanding of reality. When we view spirituality as a function of understanding, we see that opportunities for spiritual growth are literally all around us. From books and Beethoven, to the wonders of scientific discovery, to the people we call our families and friends. Nature has equipped us with a seemingly infinite capacity for understanding. Putting that capacity to good use is what spiritual growth is all about. Let's move on now to another spiritual experience, one that I call spiritual awakening. Spiritual awakening is a kind of spiritual growth. In fact, spiritual growth is really all-encompassing. If you think of spiritual growth as a tree, you can think of spiritual awakening as one branch on that tree. But it's an important branch. The experience of spiritual awakening is characterized by a profound change in how you understand yourself within the broader context of reality. Landmark theories in science during the past few centuries have compelled many of us to radically alter the way we view ourselves in the grand scheme of things. One such landmark theory was Darwin's theory of evolution by natural selection. Before Darwin, it was generally believed that the human species was a special creation of God, separate from all other life. Evolution effectively did away with this separation and revealed our biological kinship with all living things. Evolution is a marvelous idea. At least I think so. But an intellectual understanding of evolution does not, by itself, constitute an experience of spiritual awakening. Merely grasping the mechanics of the thing is not enough. Spiritual awakening only takes place when the understanding becomes personal. Let me share with you a personal experience. A few years ago, I was taking one of my evening strolls on a nearby golf course. On this particular evening, I had evolution on my mind. I had been reading Richard Dawkins' book, The Blind Watchmaker, which is a book about evolution. Reading the works of Dawkins and others, I had developed a basic understanding of how evolution worked, and I found the process quite fascinating. But my understanding of evolution had yet to become personal. That evening, about halfway down the fairway of hole number 2, it became personal. As I was walking down the fairway, I was suddenly struck with the realization that I was actually a part of this process I had been reading about. I was in the middle of it. I was it. This moment of realization was so palpable and so dramatic that I remember having to stop, literally stop, right there in the middle of the second fairway and just try to absorb this thing. I was going through what some people might call a massive paradigm shift. Do you remember how you felt on September 11th? How within the space of maybe less than a minute, your perception of the world changed in a very fundamental way? And do you remember feeling a bit disoriented as your mind struggled to process what it was witnessing? That's kind of how I felt on the golf course that night. Only unlike September the 11th, this was positive. During the course of a few short seconds, I came to see myself in a whole new context. It was like I had stepped out of one world and into another. I was no longer simply watching a movie about evolution. I was now starring in it. It was truly a moment of awakening. As this realization began to sink in, my imagination kicked into high gear, exploring the implications of this new understanding. Here's what I imagined, and you might want to try this yourself sometime. I imagined that I had a stack of 8x10 photographs. In each photograph was a picture of one of my direct ancestors on my father's side. The stack of photographs was arranged in chronological order so that the picture on the top of the stack was a picture of me. Directly under my picture was a picture of my father. After that was a picture of his father. After that was a picture of his father's father, and so on, generation after generation. Anyway, I imagined myself digging into this stack of photographs and pulling out the picture, 100 photographs down. This would be my direct ancestor on my father's side 100 generations ago. Now, yes, I know they didn't have cameras back then, but I'm imagining this, so work with me here. Now, 100 generations back would put us somewhere around the time of Alexander the Great. And as I imagine myself looking at this picture, I remember being struck by the realization that there was a real guy walking the planet back in the days of Alexander the Great who was one of my direct ancestors. A real guy. And here was his picture. For some reason, thinking in terms of these photographs made my ancestral past come alive for me. I could imagine myself going through this stack, one photo at a time. And after 100 photographs, I would get to this guy. But then I could turn right around and come back up through the stack, and eventually I would get back to me. Thinking of it in these terms underscored for me the fact that there is a real connection between me and this guy who walked the planet back in the days of Alexander the Great. Of course, I couldn't stop there. I had to dig deeper into the stack. 1,000 photos, 2,000, 3,000, 10,000 photographs into the stack. And as I dug deeper into the stack, I tried to imagine what the faces in these photographs might look like. And that's when it hit me. I suddenly realized that if I kept digging deeper into the stack, there would come a point when the faces in the photographs would begin to depart from what you and I would recognize as being human. We would see the features of the faces slowly, but surely, begin to change. We would see more hair around the face. We would see the forehead starting to slope back. We would see evolution. Yet through all of this evolution, these men or animals or whatever it is we choose to call them, they were real. They actually lived, and each and every one of them was one of my direct ancestors. I get goosebumps every time I think about this. Something else that gives me goosebumps is a realization that there are probably billions of photographs in this stack. These billions of photographs tell the story of my very real and very personal link to the beginning of all life on Earth. That's what I mean by personal. For me, evolution is no longer just a theory in a textbook. Evolution is the very real context in which I understand who and what I am. Each of us has a stack of photographs, and somewhere in my stack is a photograph that is also in your stack. I don't know how far down that photograph is, but it's there somewhere. What this means is that there is a real, understandable connection between you and me. And this connection doesn't stop with human beings. It extends to all life. That's the real epiphany of evolution. For example, I think of my dog, Max. Max has his own stack of photographs. And somewhere deep in his stack, there's a photograph that's in my stack too. That plant on your windowsill has a stack of photographs. Anthrax has a stack of photographs. Every living thing on this planet has its own stack of photographs. And somewhere near the bottom of all of our stacks is a picture of some distant ancestor that we all share in common. Now, we'd probably need an electron microscope to see the thing, but he's there. Understanding a scientifically based principle like evolution paves the way for us to understand ourselves in a whole new way. Spiritual awakening is the experience of transitioning into this new understanding. It can be a thrilling experience. And I'm happy to report that evolution is just one of many examples of how scientific discovery can open us to new experiences of spiritual awakening. Consider the discoveries of astronomy. Talk about paradigm shifts. In the 11th chapter of Genesis, we find the story of the Tower of Babel, a structure erected to reach into the heavens. God, apparently fearing that man might actually succeed in this bold venture, puts a halt to the enterprise by confounding man's language. Now, the universe of Genesis was tiny compared with the one we know today. And this has been the case throughout the vast majority of civilized history. In fact, it was not all that long ago that it was generally believed that the sun and stars orbited the earth. When Copernicus and others demonstrated that the earth spins on its axis and orbits the sun, the stars were necessarily pushed out to previously unimaginable distances. Our universe was getting bigger. Later, we discovered that the sun is not at the center of the universe. In fact, our sun turned out to be just another star, one of billions of stars inhabiting the huge spiral disk of the Milky Way galaxy. Our universe was getting a lot bigger. Later, we learned that our Milky Way galaxy was not at the center of the universe. In 1925, it was discovered that several fuzzy-looking objects seen through telescopes were not clouds of gas inside of our own galaxy, as once thought, but entire galaxies outside of our galaxy, each with billions of stars of their own. These galaxies, it turned out, are like islands of stars, separated from each other by vast stretches of empty space. Our universe was getting a whole lot bigger. Then, in late 1995, the Hubble Space Telescope produced a now famous photograph, the Hubble Deep Field photograph. There's an interesting story behind this photograph. Astronomers wanted to take a picture of the deepest corner of the visible universe and just see what turned up. Now, this was going to be a little tricky. You see, we live in a galaxy full of stars. The challenge to astronomers was to find a piece of the sky that wasn't obstructed by other stars. Such a patch of sky would represent a peephole out of our own galaxy that would provide a clear view all the way to the edge of the visible universe. Eventually, astronomers found their peephole. It was a little patch of sky near the handle of the Big Dipper. This peephole was extremely tiny, comparable to how a single dime would appear to the naked eye from a distance of 75 feet. But this was good enough. And so, on December 18, 1995, the Hubble Space Telescope aimed its mighty eye at this tiny target and then began snapping photographs for 10 straight days. When you take a picture with your regular camera, the exposure time is typically in the range of about 1/60th of a second. The exposure times in the photos taken by the Hubble ranged from 15 to 40 minutes. Now, that's some serious exposure time. But the astronomers wanted to allow every last iota of light to be captured on film. So the cameras of Hubble snapped away, picture after picture, nonstop, in several wavelengths of light, for 10 straight days. The result is the now famous image, the Hubble Deep Field. The picture, which by the way you can find all over the internet, is really a composite of 342 exposures taken during this 10-day period. Astronomers processed each exposure and then put them together into one final picture. Each time they added a picture, the view got deeper, revealing ever fainter objects. When they were done, they had the deepest picture ever taken of the heavens. What did the image reveal? You guessed it, a very big universe. In this single tiny patch of sky, astronomers counted more than 2,000 galaxies, some as far away as 12 billion light years. Of course, this only served to pique the astronomers' curiosity, and a few years later, in 1998, they aimed the Hubble telescope through another peephole, this time in the opposite direction. What did they find? Same thing. Galaxies everywhere. Two tiny patches of sky, thousands of galaxies. There are over 900,000 of these little patches of sky, and astronomers suspect that the images of the two deep field photographs are probably typical. The universe is a very, very big place. And this is our home. Something else to ponder is that when we combine our understanding of the universe with our understanding of evolution, it seems almost certain that life, even intelligent life, has arisen on some other planet, and probably on thousands of other planets in our galaxy alone. It's quite a thing to contemplate, really, especially since it is, in all likelihood, true. Our universe is not only big and probably full of life, but it's also astonishingly beautiful. I think it is anyway. Do an internet search sometime on NGC 4414. NGC 4414 is a galaxy, and the Hubble Space Telescope has taken some rather spectacular pictures of it. While you're at it, check out M31, the famous Andromeda galaxy. Or feast your eyes on the breathtaking Eagle Nebula, towering pillars of gas where new stars are being formed. These images are beautiful in a way that is simply impossible to put into words. You just have to see it for yourself. The lesson by now should be clear. You don't have to believe in God to stand in awe of the universe. In fact, I think the concept of God actually trivializes the universe. The notion that some little man is behind the whole thing, like some cosmic version of the Wizard of Oz, is absurd and trite. Even worse, it's a distraction. It distracts us from seeing the universe as it really is. A universe that men like Moses, Jesus, and Muhammad could not even imagine. Spirituality is that dimension of the human experience arising from one's relationship with reality. Scientific exploration enhances our relationship with reality by simply introducing us to more of it. The vastness and beauty of our universe is just one of the more spectacular examples. Another spectacular example can be found in the atomic theory of matter. In much the same way that astronomy has introduced us to the reality of the inconceivably big, the atomic theory of matter has introduced us to the reality of the inconceivably small. It's a theory that enables us to understand ourselves in ways unimaginable just a few decades ago. For one thing, the theory reveals just how really big we are. We seldom think of ourselves as big, especially in light of the discoveries in astronomy. With all this talk of galaxies and such, we tend to think of ourselves as puny. And we are puny when compared to something like a galaxy. But when compared to the atomic building blocks of all material things, we are unimaginably big. For example, there are about 10 to the power of 27 atoms in a single human body. 10 to the power of 27 is just an impossibly large number. To give you some idea of just how big this number really is, let's imagine that instead of 10 to the power of 27 atoms, we have 10 to the power of 27 billiard balls. Now, if you were to place 10 to the power of 27 billiard balls end to end in a row, this row of billiard balls would stretch for more than 8 billion light years. Think of it like this. There are more atoms in your body than there are stars in a trillion galaxies. Now, your mind can't even begin to fathom such an immense thing. Yet this unfathomable thing is what you are. Our seemingly miraculous human bodies are, in reality, just incredibly big and incredibly complex machines. Machines assembled by the blind forces of natural selection over billions of years. The great advantage of viewing your body in the context of the atomic theory of matter is that your body now becomes understandable. It functions like a machine, not like a ghost. Now, granted, it's a very complex machine. It's a machine about which we still have much to learn, but it is a machine. And because the body is a machine, it is, in principle at least, understandable. And that's a good thing, because understanding is a good thing. Understanding is the wellspring of spiritual experience. The atomic theory of matter is one of the most powerful conceptual tools in modern physics. But the theory has implications that many philosophers find troubling, implications that challenge our belief in free will. Think of it like this. Your body is made up of atoms. All atoms, whether in your body or in a billiard ball, possess mass. Mass can be thought of as an object's resistance to acceleration. Acceleration occurs whenever an object changes its speed or its direction of motion. Now here's our problem, or what some people have characterized as a problem. I don't think it's a problem. All human behavior can ultimately be reduced to an acceleration of mass. All human behavior can ultimately be reduced to your body, or some part of your body, changing its speed or its direction of motion. Try to think of an exception to this. You can't. From a football player pushing his way through the defensive line to a neuron releasing a molecule of serotonin into a synapse, all human behavior, no matter how subtle, can ultimately be reduced to an acceleration of mass. Now, it takes force to accelerate mass. Our present understanding of physics recognizes four forces and four forces only. Free will is not one of these forces. Now, I'm going to say something here that many of you will probably disagree with, but I'm going to say it anyway. Free will does not exist. Free will is an illusion. Granted, it's a very convincing illusion, but it is an illusion. Just as a flat earth is an illusion, just as a geocentric universe is an illusion, just as the special creation of human beings is an illusion. And as was the case with these other illusions, we are extremely reluctant to let go of the free will illusion, even in the face of powerful evidence to the contrary. We like our Earth at the center of the universe. We like to think that we are something more than animals. We like to think of ourselves as special, as different. In the case of free will, we like to think that in some objective way, we are above all this physics, that we are somehow exempt from the impersonal forces that govern everything else in the universe. On the surface, free will seems enticing. But in clinging to free will in an age of modern physics, we give up something. We give up the experience of understanding ourselves in a thrilling new context. We give up an experience of spiritual awakening. Evolution reveals our connection to all life on Earth. The atomic theory of matter and the other laws of physics reveal our connection with everything in the universe. When we believe that our behavior is governed by some force other than those described by modern physics, we effectively cut ourselves off from the rest of the universe. Can you see that? Our bodies and our behaviors are really patterns of matter and energy in space and time. And as such, our bodies and our behaviors are subject to the very same forces that govern everything else in the universe. Equipped with this understanding, we are now able to see ourselves in a very real and very literal way as part of the universe. Not just blobs of free will passing through, but literally part of the fabric and substance of the thing itself. Armed with an understanding of modern physics, we are now able to see ourselves as one with the universe. In the past, man understood the universe in the image of himself. That's where God comes from. Today, man is able to understand himself in the image of the universe. That's what I mean by spiritual awakening.